Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here. Today I'm being joined by Marissa Pecos, who is a first-generation farmer in the Low Country of South Carolina who focuses on land management and regeneration through the use of heritage breed livestock and permaculture on her 40-acre biodiverse farm. Marissa farms full-time with her 5-year-old sidekick daughter, Ellie, who has been by her side or on her back since the farm's inception just 5 short years ago. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
So give us a little bit of an overview of your farming operation. You guys have a lot going on down there.
Yeah, we do have a lot going on. Basically, we do pork, chicken, rabbit, duck, guinea, eggs, and veggies.
Okay.
We recently, in October of 2019, moved our first farm, which was just a 2-acre farm, to what we now have, which is a 40-acre piece of overgrown forest. And we are working on regenerating that forest into a working ecosystem for not only our animals, but for our native animals and plant species and things like that.
Very cool. Okay, so with that many enterprises, that's a lot to keep track of.
Yeah, we, you know, it seems like a lot of different enterprises, which it is, but I do a really like small amount of different things. So, you know, we keep about 100 pigs at a time and we do about 500 egg layers and about 1,000 meat chickens a year, about 300 ducks a year, and then about 100 rabbits, and then you know, 2 small garden spaces.
So talk to us a little bit about the rabbits, because I think you're actually the first guest that's actually done those on a little bit larger scale. What would you say the hardest part about raising rabbits are?
Or finding a processor.
Interesting. Okay. So you don't process those yourselves?
No.
Okay.
It's South Carolina is pretty strict with the rabbit processing. So whereas I process all of our own, well, not all of it. I also have USDA processing for some of our poultry, but a lot of my poultry that I sell in South Carolina, we're under an exemption for processing. So I process poultry. The rabbits don't fall under any kind of an exemption. And so we have to find a processor that is certified under the Department of Agriculture, but also, that they can also do rabbit. It's complicated. Rabbit almost falls in the same category as alligator. So if I have a processor that can do alligator, they probably can do rabbit, but it's like a whole different scope and certification. It's very complicated and expensive.
I can imagine. So the farm, it's 40 acres. How is it laid out? What's the mix between, let's say, forest and open?
So when we bought the land back in 2019, in October 2019, you couldn't even walk through it.
Oh, wow.
There was barely a path. And so my husband and I, you know, we kind of rented the biggest excavator that they could deliver, backhoes, track hoes, and we started, you know, skid steers. We started doing the clearing ourselves. So at this point, we've got a nice road that goes all the way back. We have basically two roads that on each side of the property. One is on one side, one's up the middle. And then we cleared about 6 acres for us. So we've got, you know, our home, which happens to be an RV, a shipping container, which we use for storage, and like a two pole barns off of the side of the shipping container. Then we've got some RV spaces that are cleared with water and electric, and then some space at the back where it's about 1 acre that's cleared for other parking, like trailers and things like that. Other than that, it's thick, dense wood.
So with that thick areas, do you, when you're trying to, let's say, set up a new area for the pigs, do you have to kind of like chainsaw your way through for the edge fence and then just let the animals kind of start tearing down the brush?
Yeah. So, you know, what we'll do is we'll either rent a backhoe or we'll use a skid steer, or we'll just go in with chainsaws depending on what our budget is for that time that we need it done. And we'll just go ahead in and make a fence line. You know, with the opening. And then like right now, because we're in our first year on this new space, our sections for rotation are really not ideal size. They're pretty large because we kind of went through on paths of least resistance through the woods to get ourselves going. And so, you know, we have five main sections of rotation over about 10, 15 acres of space. And so ideally we'd love to have, you know, 1 acre of space or less divided for each rotation. But for now we get these large sections. We start with the pigs or the goats, put them through, and then we kind of move forward to rotating our chickens through or the ducks through. And then we can go back in and clear a path and shorten our space that our rotation is in.
Gotcha. Now, is the property mostly flat or is it hilly?
No, it's super flat. Where we are, it's called the Low Country. We are in a coastal area, so we're not far from the beach as the bird flies. We are fairly low, so when we have a lot of rain and things like that, the areas around us can be, you know, prone to flooding. Our farm has some low spots, but mostly we're pretty good. We have some different drainage canals and things like that, but it's marshy, it's swampy around where we are. There's lots of alligators in our, you know, kind of coastal area. There's, it's a different kind of environment. It's not like, it's not hilly, it's super flat and
gotcha.
A lot of pine trees.
Okay, that makes sense, the pine aspect. Yeah, just because, and I'm sure, are you acid soil then?
Yeah, it's pretty acidic. But it is sandy too. We don't have, you know, a lot of clay. It differs in places that you are, it could differ vastly from the front of the farm to the back of the farm. It's interesting.
Yeah. What was your background before you got started farming?
So before I started farming, I was teaching overseas. I taught English overseas. I then worked in hospitality, and just kind of was doing like the 9-to-5 grind, like I think a lot of people do, except for, you know, far more than 9-to-5, right? You usually work for corporations and you're working way more than 40 hours a week. And I think a lot of people that are my age that are young and are starting kind of got sick of, being just another ant in line. And, I started wanting something more for my family. I wanted to do something that gave back to the community, that helped the environment. And so we started, when I got pregnant with my daughter, we started looking for our own land and so that we could homestead. And once we started doing that, I kind of realized like, this is something I'm really passionate about. I enjoy it. I'm good at it. And I think I can make a business out of this.
Yeah. So what was the step when you quit your job and decided to, what was that like? Go into it full time?
I transitioned from full time and then I worked part time for a year, and I did everything that we were doing now on, you know, a smaller scale. I did mostly delivery service instead of attending farmers markets, and sold our products via delivery. And then I started farmers markets in October of 2018. And at that point I decided that, you know, there was no way that I could really make money doing the farming if I was still going to be focusing on a part-time job. And so I just took that leap, and, you know, it was really scary, and financially we really had to tighten up. But we're pretty minimalistic. I mean, we live in an RV that we've lived in. My husband and I met, we were neighbors living in an RV park. And so that's how we met. So we've always been pretty minimal. The land has always been our most expensive piece to our operation. We don't own a tractor. We don't have big equipment. So you know, we're able to do things ourselves. And so if we just tightened up and really buckled down, you know, we made it, and we made it work. And so the financial part is always the biggest struggle, and the fear of being able to pay your general bills, the biggest hurdle. And then we sold publicly for a year before we decided to get more land. And so we did everything that we do now on a smaller scale on 2 acres. And it, but I was always, I mean, our finances were always such a stressful part of it, because I was never producing enough to actually pay for anything more. And it was kind of like we're on this treadmill of trying to be successful, but not really, not that we didn't have the resources financially, but more so the resources in land. And, you know, I remember a lot of crying, a lot of stress, worrying that this was never going to happen. And so we just, I saw that this land was for sale at one point, and I said, you know, this is crazy, but let's try it. And somehow we made it work.
Yeah. So did you have like for startup expenses? Because obviously once you move on to a larger property, everything scales. So did you have like outside funding, or how did you get going, or just bootstrap it?
So, you know, when we bought our first piece of land, we bought 2 acres of raw land, and we paid $14,000 for it. That was in 2015. And when we sold it in 2019, we sold it for $65,000.
Oh, wow.
Without a house on it. Just had a barn, a little guest house like that we used for visitors. It's had the fencing, it had the electricity, the piping. I mean, we did everything. We dug a pond. And so it was really ready for someone to take over that wanted to homestead, but that also wanted to live in a tiny home or do something like that. And so with the money that we got from the sale of the property, we put down money on our new land. And we took the rest of the money that was left over, and that's where we rented our track hose. That's where we laid our piping for our water line. We put in our well. We did the septic. You know, we had the septic put in. We got the all the electricity ran, and then some of the starts of fencing and stuff like that. Now, my husband, he works a regular job, and so we have his income as well, and so that obviously that helps. But yeah, I mean, we took the money that we got from the sale of the first property, and that's the only way that we were able to get the land that we have now.
Yeah. Got it. Wow. That is a, that's stepping out and doing and trying new things. I know that part can be incredibly hard just to go to that next scale, because it's a lot, there's a lot more chance for error at that next scale, which is, you know, 100 pigs, that sort of investment.
Yeah. I think the great thing is that we had the chance on 2 acres to make a lot of mistakes. So we did on a small scale what a lot of people try to do on a large scale at first. And, you know, it only was when I said I can do more. The only thing that's holding me back is space, that we were able to do this. And the new farm is 15 minutes from where the old farm was. And so we had 30 days to clear off enough space to get all the animals moved, get ourselves moved, and then we had to be off the old farm. And so we started implementing electric fencing instead of putting up permanent structures. I built a chicken coop on a old boat trailer. Yep. And I built that at the old farm. And then the night that we moved the chickens, I put them in there, drove them over to the new farm, and in the morning I let them out. And you know, and so there was a lot of things that, like, at our old farm, we had a permanent chicken coop, and we had a lot of other things that were, you know, that we had done on a more sustainable level, but not necessarily regenerative. And it was easy to make that transition when you say, here's the potential, and now I have this 40 acres where I can unleash it.
Mm-hmm. So on the 40 acres, what are some of the things that you're doing more regeneratively? I know you mentioned that you use biochar. Talk to us about how that works.
Yeah. So it's always important to not have waste, right? We all want to, especially if you're trying to, you know, have a sustainable or a regenerative farm, that our waste is really minimal, if any at all. And so one of the things that happens, obviously, is we have to go through, and we do have to thin the forest. We want our timber to thrive. We want to establish a silvopasture, but at the same time, we have to thin and cut as well. And so what happens with those trees? Well, we have a lot of saplings. We have a lot of trees that are kind of useless, right? We've got sweet gums. We have popcorn trees. It's not all oak, pine. It's not hardwood, all softwood or hardwood. It's, you know, it's different. So we've got all this wood now, and what's, nobody's going to buy it. There's not a market for that timber, and we don't have a sawmill. We don't have these things. So what do? Well, we start to burn. And after doing a lot of research and trying to figure out, you know, here are these burn piles that we have, and they're filled with these things. What can we do with it? And so biochar has been a huge component of what we do. Now, we produce biochar just for ourselves, but it's got great minerals and things in it for the livestock. So our pigs love to eat biochar. Our chickens go through it, the goats as well. And so when we are, you know, selectively cutting in these areas and we're opening up the space, we just pile any of our, you know, brush that we've got, we burn it. And then just before it turns to ash, when you've got the charcoal, we slow the burn down and let it cool. And then that's biochar for the animals. We also take it and we'll use it in our garden spaces as soil amendments. And so the, you know, where you're taking this useless trees that there's no market for, we can only stack so much firewood, we're only going to go through so much, and nobody's going to buy, you know, oh, I want to buy popcorn firewood, like, it's, you know, people are looking for oak. You've got to find a way to take that waste and use it. I mean, other options is like a biodigester, right? But that's not something that's been in our budget. So for now, we're just taking that, those tree wastes, and we're making them into supplementation for the animals. There's research being done with cattle. And if you add biochar to a diet for cattle, it, when the biochar combines in with the organic material during digestion, it actually decreases methane during output in the manure. And so it's interesting because there's all these other facets of it that you don't think about. I mean, we've noticed just more health in the skin of the animals, their weight gain, like their feed to growth ratio is better when they're getting biochar in their diet. Just a lot of, you know, a lot of things that maybe you don't think about, but here's this organic matter that's right there for you to utilize.
Absolutely. So with the biochar then, well, I guess my question is then, how many acres do you feel like you've cleared so far, and what's the long-term aspect of that? Do you know yet?
Or so is it just it takes us like a week to clear a 20th of an acre by hand.
Okay.
So, you know, and it's not clearing, it's thinning and piling trees and then getting like the large pieces of wood that we can use for firewood and separating that out, and then taking all of like your small limbs, burning that down and making your biochar. And so, you know, being the optimistic person that I am, I said, okay, great. Like 800 more days or 800 more times or weeks of doing this, and our farm will be like perfect.
Yeah.
So the you know, the long term is we're working in these small sections. And so if it's an acre that we get done a year, that's an acre that we get done by hand a year. If our finances change and we bring in, you know, a bush hog or something that we can come in and mulch more heavily, then we, you know, then we cut that time in half. But until, you know, we kind of save up that money to do the next project, we go in and we just do things by hand. So I would say 5 years for the first maybe 10 acres to be where I feel comfortable cover cropping and potentially moving cattle through is what my goal would be.
So let's talk a little bit about the time management, because, you know, as you said, there's so many things to be done. What systems have you set up to make sure that you do focus on what's the most important thing every day?
So we're really lucky with, in our area, I have, and you know, we're really, I'm a young woman with a daughter. I'm pretty transparent on social media. I'm pretty active on social media, and I seem to touch a lot of people in our area. So I get a lot of people that want to volunteer or that are looking for side work. And so one of the things is, you know, getting people to come out and volunteer is really helpful to me. I kind of vet the volunteers and make sure that they understand the work that's being done. And then they spend, you know, 1 or 2 days working side by side with me with kind of like mundane tasks. And then after that, I have them come out on days that, you know, maybe I'm at the market or maybe I have to go to the butcher. Maybe I'm butchering chickens, like on days that my time needs to be spent doing other things. And they're able to feed chickens, to feed rabbits, to, you know, make sure the pigs have water, make sure the goats have water. And then they also come out and help during times that I'm doing large projects like moving fence lines or clearing sections of the woods. You know, it's really easy to put people on jobs like we're going to pick up sticks and put them in a pile.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to allow people, and I think that's something that not all farms do, to say, hey, you know what, you can come on out. We're going to let you come out and volunteer and find, even if it takes them an hour to do a task that took you 5 minutes, you didn't do that task. So, you know, that task is off your plate. You can think about something else. You know, we have increased our sizes of our feed containers over time so that we're not, you know, I'm maybe giving chickens feed every other day instead of every day. Same thing with the water. Just kind of finding ways and within our budget that we can increase capacity without increasing our time spent on that single task. I also have one employee who works 2 days a week. And, you know, that's something that's new for us this summer. We, you know, it was always just my husband and I, and he was at work all the time. So having somebody, I put a list on Trello for my employees and all of my volunteers. They all have their own list. And that way they can come out and they can kind of focus in on what they need to do, get done what they want to do. And, you know, I can see what tasks they completed and what they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So what would you say the hardest part of the farm is for you?
I mean, I think buckling down and doing the financials is really hard, you know.
So the office work,
making the time to sit inside on the computer, looking at cost of goods, you know, money out, money in, you know, all of those things are hard. And it's easy to sit and think about how much money you need to make to, you know, it doesn't take me that long to look at chicken and say, okay, so this is how much I make for chicken. This is how much it costs me to raise the chicken. This is how much I need to charge. But then to take that and break it down into all the pieces of, okay, so I have the chicken that I'm selling for X amount for this many pounds, but when I break it down into breasts and the weights and, you know, what's my return on investment? Is it worth it to break the chicken down? You know, that's what people want, but am I really making more money when I take the extra time?
Yeah.
Tracking my time, paying myself for my time. I pay myself like $2 an hour, and that's not when I don't always track my time. I mean, I work from 6 a.m. until 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So I'm not always tracking my time, but when I drive to the butcher, when I, you know, I can say, okay, I spent this much time at the market every week. So taking the time to really just look at what my cost is and doing those numbers is something that is hard for me because there's a million things outside that are begging for your attention.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So with that though, are you also tracking like the improvements on your property, like the investments and how the property is appreciating? Because I think if you did that, then it'd actually make your wage probably double.
Yeah, it probably would.
But the $4.
$4 now. The thing is, when you're starting, like I was looking at, you know, our finances for 2019 versus 2020. And like, I see our revenue, right? And it's great. It's been wonderful. We've, you know, more than doubled and we're not even through 2020 yet.
Yeah.
However, that's all great to say, yet we spend so much money every single month on, you know, now we have way more animals than we ever had. We have way more fencing than we ever had. I have an employee now. There's all these costs. And so you're still not really profiting. Like, you know, you look at your sales, great, but at the end of the day, it's all relative.
Yeah.
And so I think until we really can get some like residual income of a steady stream of something that kind of maintains itself, then we won't really truly be able to take that next step, I guess, and do even more, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I get that. Who would you say have been your mentors over the years as you started your farm?
So, you know, everybody talks about, like, you know, the Joel Salatin and things like that. When I started farming, you know, 5 years ago, I really didn't know anybody like that, or I didn't follow anyone like that. And even today, I mean, I might look at systems, but I never really follow a certain person. My mentors and inspiration have really been like the local people in my area. Mm-hmm. And so there's a woman, her name is Mary Connor, and she owns Three Sisters Certified Organic Farm, and that's in Bluffton, which is about 30 minutes from us. And she's an older woman. She and her three sisters, or her two other sisters, have the farm. And I worked for Mary for a little bit to try to learn a little bit more about veggies, because animals have always kind of been my wheelhouse, but the veggies, you know, is something that I'm still really learning about. And she's just always been so encouraging and, you know, always reminded me to make sure I see value in what we do and charge enough money if I want to actually survive and have enough, you know, money to farm, you know, and that's been so helpful to me, because as I've gotten more experience, as I've, my products have improved over time, I have charged more. And I charge more for my time. You know, I do a lot of other consulting and things like that. And now that I have more knowledge, I feel comfortable enough where I can say, hey, I'm worth it. And so that's really helpful. Mary actually turned me on to you and your podcast and all of your, you know, the things that you do. And I saw Mary yesterday and told her that I was going to be on your podcast, and she was kind of like fangirling. It was very funny.
That's awesome. Well, like, you know,
oh my God, I can't believe you're going to be on a call with Michael Kilpatrick. Oh, yeah, girl.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. And we just enjoy bringing all sorts of folks on just so we can share all different perspectives. And so that's just part of it, is just, you know, it's one of those things, like, I saw also on your website, and actually we can switch to talking about this, is your consumer events where you have people come out and do like farm tours and stuff like that. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's one thing I can learn from you, because that's something we really want to focus on in our new farm. And we're already doing that. So we have a sunflower field, and we've had hundreds of people out over the last 10 to 12 days. But I want to hear, you know, in detail, kind of like, how do you set those up, and like, how do you structure those events?
I mean, I think the big thing, and I think what a lot of farmers don't realize, is like, you're a brand. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not just your products are one thing that from your farm, but your farm is a brand, and you, the farmer, are the brand. Mm-hmm. And so for us, getting people excited to meet me at the farmer's market, finding ways to inspire people that I meet at these markets or places, and then getting them excited to want to come out to the farm, is really important. I mean, it's one thing to be at the farmer's market or at, you know, wherever you sell your products and people know your brand, but to get to know you as a person and what drives you and all the things that you do on a day to day, that's really exciting for people. And I think over time we have developed an excitement about our farm locally that makes people want to learn more about us. Now, yes, I have, you know, like times where it's just moms want to come out and their kids want to look at the animals, and that's fine. But that's not really what we want to do. You know, we want to connect with a demographic of people that cares about the environment, that wants to make a difference in their community and see the value in things. And so by kind of building up the excitement of what we do and sharing so much on our social media and on our websites and how transparent I am and, you know, things like that on our blogs, I think it's really built up a fan base locally where people want to come out and they want to experience it.
Yeah.
A lot of people tell me all the time, like, this is their, oh, you're living my dream. Now, you know, when I started, I didn't necessarily have this as a dream. I had a dream of being closer to the land, doing something for the environment, but it wasn't, you know, I didn't see myself doing this at the beginning, and now I do, but it's incredibly hard work, you know, and it's like, you're working a ridiculous amount of hours. We're not making very much money, but to be able to have people say, you're living my dream, or you're so inspiring, and get them excited to come out, that's where you're going to make a little bit more money. And so having the farm tours is something that we do, you know, for our customers that request to come out for a farm tour, or for anybody that wants to learn a little bit more about what we do. I have a lot of people that say, well, Marissa, I really want to come out because we're buying a piece of land. And how many people probably reach out to you about that, that are maybe in your area? I don't know. You know, does that happen to you often?
It's becoming more and more. I mean, obviously, because now we're developing a local presence. Before we had a national presence, but now we're actually starting to develop that local presence. So people from Kentucky and Indiana and Ohio are now like, hey, I want to come visit or see what you're doing. So yeah, it's absolutely starting to grow.
And so the thing that's really hard about that is like, how do you put value on, you know, remember that your time is valuable. And so I just start telling people, like, I offer consultations where you can come out to the farm or I can come to you and talk to you about what your goals are and talk to you about, you know, things that you can do to achieve them. I remember when I first started, there was a woman that was nearby and she had just bought land. She knew nothing about what she was doing. And really, I mean, I was also just starting my business. And I put in the work and it was so frustrating because she would text me all the time and just ask me all kinds of things. And it got to the point where I was like, I'm like, dude, like, you know, if you want to sit down with me and you want to like drill me, you can, but I can't spend any more time just giving you all of my knowledge for nothing. And so I have found that finding value in what I do, because you would never say to a lawyer friend, you know, hey, I'm having this problem with, you know, this related to this law or suing. Can you sit down with me for, you know, 8 hours and give me all of your time so I can ask you all these questions that I have? Or a doctor. I mean, why do we do it to farmers? Why do we think that, you know, their time isn't as valuable? And so I thought to myself, you know what, this is how we start doing it. And so the consultations and the farm tours and having people come out and see what we do and getting excited about what we do and then talking to them about how they can do it too. Because, go ahead, were you going to say something?
No, that's great. And I've got a couple follow-up questions, but I also had like, I like where you're going with that is like, you know, a lawyer friend, we wouldn't ask them to just sit down. And, you know, it's one of those things, like, as we're starting to build out this new farm, there's certain things that I have questions about. And I want to deep dive into something. And so I've hired multiple people and paid them for their time. And it's not cheap. But I know that I'm downloading a dozen years of their life and thousands of hours of their research and time and mistakes, and literally for pennies and pennies on the dollar. And yeah, that $300 an hour consulting rate is not something to sneeze at, but it's I know that it's saving me thousands of dollars and making the wrong decisions.
Correct. And like right now, I'm still a young new farmer, right? I'm no Jill Salatin. Okay. My consulting rate is $35 an hour. Mm-hmm. It's like super low. And, you know, usually if you pay me for a consultation and you come out or I go to you after we establish that initial relationship and I see that you value my time because you paid me for 2 hours or whatever, you can pretty much text me whenever you want.
Yeah.
But you better believe that you're not just going to make friends with me so that you can use me for all of the knowledge that I have, because I would never do that to someone else. Because I value people's time. And just like you said, pay somebody to give you, you know, the information so that it does save you time and money in the end.
Yeah.
And that's when you have to see the value in yourself and you have to say, you know what, all of this that I've done, it's actually worth something.
So another part of that too, is sometimes you're paying someone for their knowledge so that you know not to do that. So I hired someone to do a detailed, build out a detailed climate battery idea for one of our new greenhouses. And basically based on that, based on his time and effort and just going through that and creating that plan, I realized that's not in our budget this year. Mm-hmm. And that was a great thing because it saved me $25,000.
Right.
So being able to just, some of that stuff to not do as well. So when you do, like, people come on farm and do the tours, do you have a specific flow to the tour? So let's say you're doing customers that you just want to kind of like get them more interested in the farm and like to share your, do you have like a flow that you take them through, or is it kind of just like you tour them around different parts?
I mean, you know, I'm pretty chill and we kind of just go for a little walking tour, and I take him and I say, like, here's an example of where we started. Like, this is what the forest looked like. And as you walk the farm, it's set up in a way that you can see all the different transitional spaces. So you can see like where the goats are now, where the chickens are, where the pigs are, where they had been, what's been on rotation, what's off, what's being cover cropped. So it's like, you know, I did a farm tour this morning, and it was, they came at 10 and the tour finished at 11:45. And so it's a long tour if you want it to be. And, you know, it could be for kids. It could be a half an hour walk, or it could be a really in-depth tour where we talk about the biochar and we talk about the rotation and we talk about what we're cover cropping and we look at the soil and what the soil looks like where I left the pigs on too long and the compaction. And we look at, you know, just all these different kinds of aspects. And depending on how much interest someone has, that's the tour that I give them. And then, you know, if it's a great customer of mine, that someone that spends maybe thousands of dollars a year with me, they're going to get however long of a tour they want. And it's going to be free. But, you know, if somebody else is coming in here that is truly looking for information because they want to start their own business or their own farm, like, I'll give them as much of a tour as they want, but I'm going to charge for that. Because I want to be supported in what I'm doing no matter what. So whether that means that you spend thousands of dollars on my products every year, or you pay me for my time when I'm touring you because you never buy products from me, either way, my time is valuable. And so it just depends on the individual and what they're looking for, you know, and how interested in agriculture they are, or how interested in the environment they are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If there was a magic reset button as relates to going, let's say you go back to, I think you said October, you bought the new place. If you could change something about that, what would you go back and put in place sooner?
You know, it's hard because we're talking about October moving to this new farm, whereas like we got a reset.
Yeah.
Like, that 2-acre farm that we had, we did all kinds of things on that farm that I would never do again. And so I got the chance in October to come through and I could say, you know, this is what I would do. This is what I would do different. And I did it. You know, something that I think I underestimated moving to the new land was our predators problems. Mm. You know, we came here with 125 chickens, and that was in October. And by March I had 5.
Ooh.
And it wasn't during the night that it was happening. It was during the daytime. And I didn't have a livestock guardian dog. We kind of had nothing in place except for electric fencing that would deter the predators. And so that was something that maybe looking back, I would change. Now, I never even saw the predators. You know, they were coming during the day. The land is huge. You know, this is a big piece of land. It's completely overgrown. You don't look through one section and see. I mean, you can look out and you can maybe see, I don't know, 50 feet. That's how thick it is. So these predators are stealthy and they were coming and, you know, and my husband kept saying like, you know, oh, Marissa, you know, you're losing chickens during the day. And I'd be like, no, I'm not. And like my life is spent proving him wrong. And, and like, literally that's all I do constantly is try to prove him wrong. And then a lot of times he's right though. And, you know, so I'm so stubborn that I didn't believe it until I was counting chickens and going, oh my God, you're right. You know? And he's like, you should have them back that far. And I'm like, wow. Okay. I guess you're right. But I spend a lot of time saying, no, James, rah, 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 you know, you're wrong. You're not the farmer. And you know, I was wrong.
Yeah. And so to solve that, obviously the guardian dog, and what kind of guardian dog do you have?
So we actually rescued a German Shepherd. Back in the beginning of April, and the rescue told me, you know, don't waste my time with him. He has a huge prey drive and he's going to kill everything you got. And just like everything else in with my husband wanting to prove him wrong, you know, I decided that I wanted to prove the rescue wrong too. And then when I got the dog and he came and he killed a bunch of stuff, then my husband said, you know, you need to take him back. And I said, well, now I'm going to have to prove you wrong too. So I tethered Johnny to me for weeks, and every time I was out working 10, 12 hours a day, Johnny was attached to me with a leash. And we just worked and worked and worked until it got to the point where he started realizing like, oh, I'm not supposed to chase these chickens.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be protecting them. And, you know, and so now he's a great, he is a super important part of our farm. And he actually was just featured in a local, well, it's like more of a regional agriculture magazine, as a working dog. And he actually, his main job is guarding the farm, but also herding pigs. And really? So he is a wonderful pig herder. And he, because we use electric fencing for our hogs and we, you know, we train our piglets on the electric fencing, our like young pigs that are probably between like 4, 3, and 5 months old will oftentimes continue to test, you know, say, this is worth it. This is worth it to get, you know, zapped and get out. And Johnny, I mean, all I have to do is now is tell him to get it and he will just put that pig right back in. And so he's got a huge presence on the farm. He runs the whole property. I mean, he's all over the place and, you know, he still has his moments with the chickens at times, but generally he's amazing. He barks at night if something is around, you know, he might not go after it always at night, but he definitely lets us know when something's out and, you know, alerts us. And so he's been a great addition and I would love to get more, you know, livestock guardian, like a more traditional livestock guardian for our different sections of rotation, but I'm a huge fan of rescuing. And so I've been, you know, I'm on a bunch of like rescue wait lists for livestock guardian dogs.
Mm-hmm, because they're out there. I remember when New York, when we had a couple and when we ended up in 2015, we started shutting everything down. We had these dogs and there needed to be some place to go. And thankfully we were able to find people that could take them. But it was, you know, that was a hard part because they were so friendly and, we had Maremmas and they're just such a great dog. There are, some of those dogs are really for the northern climates because they have so much hair. So you have to be really careful about that because they don't overheat, but yeah, absolutely a key part of our farm and just being able to, you know, they just stayed out with the chickens or the turkeys. Actually, the turkeys was their main job and just kept them safe.
Yeah. I mean, he's amazing. And you know, I would buy a dog, but I just know how many dogs are out there that need homes. And, you know, I'm willing to just kind of wait until I get that right, until I find that right fit again. And then maybe somebody will tell me I can't do something and I'll do it because that's what I do.
With that, I'd like to stop here and take a quick break. In a minute, we'll be back with Marissa from Whippoorwill Farms. Hey, thriving farmers. Have you checked us out on YouTube lately? We have a bunch of new content there, including a few rants by me. I want to tell you, you don't want to miss them. I actually go rant about, you know, some of the problems I see in our space and some of the challenges I see farmers facing. So go check that out. We've got instructional videos over there as well. Talk about setting up our new farm here in Ohio and all the steps we're going to do that, as well as just tutorials and tips on best practices for all sorts of things on the farm. So go ahead, check over at Growing Farmers on YouTube and see the new content we put together for you. We are back with Marissa. So Marissa, tell us, do you farm alone? You talked about you have one employee. How does that work and how do you divide roles on the farm?
So, you know, when we first started, even back in October, when we moved to the new land, I pretty much did everything. And my husband, he works for a company where he operates cranes. He does like a lot of heavy equipment. He knows electrical, plumbing, all kind of mechanical stuff. And so his role on the farm, and this has always been established, is mostly like infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to road building or big machinery, I do run the biggest machinery, but when we moved here, I flipped a skid steer that cost us about $5,000. I got a backhoe stuck. So James is really the infrastructure guy. So if I need something built or if I want to improve something, he's the one to do it. If I need help putting up fences, he'll help. He'll grumble a little bit, but he will help. And I think it's important to note that James is almost 30 years older than I am. And so, you know, our stamina, even at that age, he still outworks me, but he'd much rather not be pounding T-posts into the ground if he could help it. And so all of that, he and I pretty much have roles that are understood. Now, when it comes to like the day-to-day on the farm, if I can outsource feeding to an employee or a volunteer so that I can put more effort into marketing or maybe a fencing project, or maybe, you know, using a chainsaw so I can clear some space or whatever. That's what I'm going to do. And so, you know, I try and work with the volunteers that I have and the employee that I have to find out what their strengths are and what really what their interests are. Because if you keep them doing stuff that they're not really interested in, you're not going to maintain them. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's finding what they like to do and then finding jobs in their wheelhouse. Yes, of course, we all have to do things that we don't like to do at times, but trying to figure out what they enjoy and then putting them onto those jobs and having that be like a focal point of them coming out. If I have somebody that really just loves being around the animals and that's all they want to do, then they can do all the feeding. They can do, you know, the watering. If I have somebody that's not interested in the animals and they would rather garden, then they can do weeding. They can do planting. And if I have somebody that's, you know, wants to do a little bit of everything, then they can do that as well. But it's finding people's strengths and then delegating based on their strengths and their interests is what I've found.
So do you have people that come out to volunteer and are like, well, my volunteering is going to look like this, and they're not quite, you know, doing exactly what you want? And how do you deal with that?
So when people ask to volunteer at the farm, I basically try and discourage them. Mm. And I say, you know, it's super hard work. I mean, it is grunt work. It's not a lot of fun at first. You have to get to know our like schedule, how we do things, our operation before I even let you near the animals. And at that point, if they're like, yeah, that sounds great, then I say, okay, well, come on. You know, and some people might say, oh, okay, well, let me think about it and I'll let you know. And that's totally fine. And I'm never going to hear from them again. But the people that when I tell them like it's a horrible experience, don't come and do it, they're the ones that are like, it sounds perfect. And that's what I'm looking for. And so they come out and, you know, they'll spend a day with me. We might work 4 hours together, and I'll kind of take them through different things and talk to them about their background, about why they wanted to volunteer, really kind of get to know them a bit. And as they're following me around, I'm doing chores. So it's not, you know, really wasting any of my time. They're helping a little bit. And then after that first day, you know, I check in and I say, like, what did you think? Is this what you expected it to be? And a lot of times they'll say like, yes, when can I come back? And that's when I know, okay, great. Like we can get a second day in and figure out their next step and how far they're going to go. If they say to me, yeah, this was great. And I say, okay, well, when do you want to come back? And they say something like, I need to check my schedule. Then I kind of know, okay, they're not super into it, and that's okay. And so usually, you know, I try and get people to come out once a week. If they're going to volunteer, I tell them, if you can come out once a week, if that's what you want to do, you'll get to know things better. You'll be able to do things more on your own. You'll get to know the animals quicker, and, you know, you'll find a groove on the farm. If you want to come once a month, I'm pretty much just going to put you on picking up sticks. And if that's what you want, then great. You can come on out. And so I just try and be as honest with people as I can about what it looks like to volunteer on the farm.
Do you allow any specific hours?
I don't care. I mean, okay. I work from 7 a.m. outside until dark. So anybody wants to come whenever they want is okay with me.
Gotcha.
I'm very laid back about the volunteers. I know like there's other farmers in our area that don't allow any volunteers because they think it wastes their time. But if you find the right ones and you can, you know, really kind of cultivate that relationship with the right volunteers, you can really, you can do some amazing things. Like I had to go to New Jersey for a funeral recently, and we had the entire week that I was gone because I drove and I took meat and sold meat while I was up there. And so I ended up driving, and the whole time that I was gone, it was all volunteers and James.
Oh, wow. You
know, that's who took care of the farm. So I had people coming, on the mornings from 9 to 12, I had these tasks for them. I had afternoon checkers. Then I had evening help. James would be here. And, you know, if you've got three people coming a day, plus your husband, somebody's going to miss something, and then somebody's going to figure out what you missed and be able to take care of it. And so that was it was amazing to have all of that help and have people that were interested in making sure that, you know, everyone was taken care of while I went away.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have like SOPs or written instructions for some of the tasks on the farm to help people remember?
Yes. I do have, like, when I went away, I printed like a survival guide.
Okay. I love that. Survival yeah. guide.
I mean, like, literally, this is how that you need to make sure the animals survive.
Yeah.
But I use Trello, and you know, every single person that comes and works or volunteers has like a task list on Trello. And so whatever day they come, I update it the night before. And then, so like, if I have someone that comes on Tuesdays and Saturdays when I'm at the farmer's markets, they just come and they look at their Trello and they do the tasks and then they head on out, you know, and they'll check in with me after and say, you know, I encountered this problem or this. And then other days they'll do their Trello and then they'll come to me and say, what projects are we working on today?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. All right. So let's talk a little bit about marketing, because as you scale, you obviously have to find new customers. Where do you focus on selling?
So we sell at farmers markets mostly. And then I offer delivery. And the delivery is something that I wish more people would take advantage of because it's free delivery. And so when the pandemic hit, we were doing a lot of delivery. Because nobody wanted to go to the grocery store. But at this point, I think people have kind of slowed down. And they also almost, I think folks feel bad about having you deliver. Like I have customers that I won't see them at the farmer's market for maybe 3 months and they'll finally come by and they'll say, you know, oh, I'm so sorry I hadn't gotten here. I've been so busy. And I'm like, you remember I deliver for free, right? And they're like, well, I don't want you to have to go out of your way. And like, I've tried and remind them, like, if you just buy one, you know, if you spend $50 with me, like that is not going out of my way. That's worth it for me. So if I had five customers that spent $50 every week on delivery, that's an extra $250 that I wasn't going to get,
yeah, if,
you know, from you not coming to the markets. And so
I'm wondering an aspect though of that is, what if you said a $5 donation for delivery? So they wouldn't feel bad about, because they could just, you could just say, or you can donate if you want to cover our costs to those people. Cause obviously they're your best customers and I'm sure they'd be more than happy to pay. We're seeing a lot more delivery. And I know some people still doing it for free, but they're saying it's killing them because it costs them literally $10 is what they estimate it costs them in labor for someone to actually go do it. But I mean, people are now used to paying for delivery, especially with DoorDash and ClickList and all this kind of stuff. So I think if you started to implement a cost on that. Now, another question for you too is, could some of your volunteers do this delivery?
So I like the donation idea, and I may start implementing that. That's a great idea. You know, maybe add that on just when they order online on the website as an additional, you know, cart item. And then I do actually have a volunteer on Tuesday mornings who does my deliveries for me.
Uh-huh. And
so I do have one day a week. I have someone that does deliveries, but I don't have somebody on Saturdays that does my deliveries. I do them. Gotcha. So yeah, if I did have a volunteer that I could use in that, we're in Savannah, Georgia on Saturdays, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So promotion, I know you're on Instagram, so you do that. Where else do you find is good for putting out content or just connecting with people?
So we're really active on Facebook too. And then I try to connect with like other local businesses in the area. And I do a lot, you know, I also do some paid marketing, not just on social, but I run print ads as well. And that's a really non-traditional, or I'm sorry, it's a very traditional form of advertising. I would think more non-traditional for someone my age and in a farm business. You don't often see farmers putting print ads out. But our demographic here, we're in like the retirement zone. And so all of these people from the Northeast have come down to Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, to Bluffton, South Carolina. There's like a lot of these like very wealthy retirement communities in the area. And so they love to read a newspaper from front to back. And they're also the people that are out golfing, you know, they have their golf groups, you know, every day of the week, or they're out, you know, playing bridge or whatever it is that these people do. They have this disposable income, and generally they're older. They want to take care of themselves. And so our demographic, when I first started, I thought our demographic was like young moms like me that wanted to give our kids the best food. Well, yeah, we are out there. However, when push comes to shove, like there, if it comes between saving up for Disney World or saving up for organic chicken, most likely they're going to save up for Disney World.
Yeah.
And so I learned really quickly that that wasn't my demographic. And so I started trying to figure out, well, who the heck is buying from me? And doing the farmers markets really helped me see who my audience was, because it's a lot of people that, you know, were highly educated, you know, doctors, lawyers, people with their PhDs, professors at universities that have now retired and come down to the South, you know, people that have this disposable income, but also really care about the environment, really love supporting local, love the, you know, the fact that our carbon footprint is small, and then want to see a young woman succeed. And so by putting ads in print, you're kind of hitting that demographic of people that want to stay informed. They are, you know, they want to be educated. And then of course you have people that read the paper that are just looking for, like, you know, the whatever entertaining stories they have. But a lot of them do see. I mean, I go to the farmers markets and I'll put a run an ad in the paper and people will say, I saw your article. And I'm like, it's not an article, but thank you. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, but they're seeing it. They do see it. And so just figuring out what your demographic is. And a good way to do that is by using social media to first figure out who your audience is. And then once you can drill that down on social media, taking that to your local media group and saying, this is who my most engaging audience is. What products do you have for that? What print products do you have? Or what, you know, how can I reach that? Because social media gives you all the analytics that print doesn't. But yeah, you can find your audience by looking at your analytics on social.
Absolutely. So talk to us about the farm stay aspect, because that's very interesting to me too, that you've got people coming out now and just, how does that work?
So we do a lot of RVs. We started that at the old farm. And so we had like 3 RV spaces with hookups, like just water and electric, that people could come and stay and visit the farm, but also get like a lower cost place overnight. And so when we moved to this new farm, we're closer to Interstate 95, which is like a big interstate on the East Coast. And we, you know, implemented more hookups and we have more to offer now. You know, we have more products. We're doing something more interesting. It's not just a sustainable farm. It's a regenerative farm. I remember when we first moved here and we continued doing these RV guests, people would come and they'd be like, is this where the farm is? And I'd be like, you know, I want to slap them. I'd be like, yes, this is the farm. This is what the farm looks like right now. Okay. I told you it was rustic. Like, you know, it would drive me crazy, but now we're getting more established. Things are starting to look more like a farm, and people come and they find it really interesting because it's not what the typical farm looks like. You know, there's electric fencing everywhere. There's not a red barn. There's not rolling hills with cattle. There's, you know, 100 pigs snorting through the woods and tearing up the ground, you know, so it's interesting to them. And so we've got the RV spaces, people pay to hook up. They stay for one night, they stay for a week, however long they want to stay. I have them pay in advance. I have a cancellation policy. And, you know, if they want a farm tour when they come, they can walk around with me. But I generally, like, you know, for the RVs that come in, I don't really go too much out of my way, aside from what my regular day is, to walk them around and talk to them. Now, the other thing that we do is we actually have a little retro camper that we rent, and that's for like farm experiences. And so like when those people come, they get, you know, the prime spot, fire pit, picnic table. We stock firewood for them. We start their fire for them. We've got a propane grill. They've got like, you know, a hammock, everything that they might want to use for a camping trip. They've got a full stocked RV with all the utensils, plates, everything that they might need, the fridge. And then they might buy, like, I have people that give it as gifts, give the farm stay or the farm experience as a gift. And they'll say, well, they want to do a butchering class too, or they want to purchase, you know, can you have a whole chicken marinated for them and have that ready to go on the grill? Like, we don't do the cooking, but I surely will thaw a chicken and marinate it for them and put it in their fridge so that they're ready to go when they get here. And so we really try and cater to those people. And then we give them free rein of the farm. You know, we say, walk around. enjoy? You want to collect the eggs? You can come with me and collect the eggs. Like, what is the experience that you're looking for? And we cater to them. And we can make pretty good money on a weekend where we have, you know, somebody staying and looking for that experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with that farms, the camper, do you have that on your website only, or do you have it on other like farm sites or Airbnb?
So far, I don't have it on even my website.
I've
advertised it on social media so far. I have a page almost ready on the website, but I haven't quite gotten there yet. That's one of those things that we talked about earlier, that buckling down, mm-hmm. and doing computer work thing. So yeah, it's on social media, and that's how I've gotten bookings on it so far. I've started an Airbnb account. I've started a Hip Camp account, and I haven't followed through. The fees, they just turn me off so badly. And so I just wonder if I could continue maybe using, even if I book it out less and I don't have to pay fees, I'm still making the same amount of money.
Yeah, my mom actually has their garage, has a little apartment above it, and she is killing it on Airbnb. And literally, I'm just blown away by how much booking she gets and where she is located, because she's not like on the main drag. She's on this, you know, neighborhood and not a huge traffic area in Virginia. And she's booked all every night. It blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so close to getting there. I just haven't gotten there yet. And then, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, the RV is now I have an RV, at least one RV out almost every single night. And if not, on the weekends, I might have six RVs in here. But when you do the math on the return on investment, and, you know, granted, yeah, the return on the investment, the initial investment is high, right? Because we're talking about we rent a backhoe or something to clear the space out to pull all the tree stumps up.
Yeah.
And then we get gravel, we pour gravel, we have to spread the gravel. I mean, the initial, we run the power line, we run the water line. The initial investment is high. Mm-hmm. However, when you break down what they're getting, water and electric, and then what you've put into it, I might have water and electric out here. And my, let's say my power bill is, you know, X amount of dollars per month, and I break it down and I look at how many dollars per day. And if it's $8 per day and I've got three RVs in here one night and they all pay $30 each, that's $90. That's like, what is that markup?
It's massive.
So you do make it back. And even if my products, even if I don't have a 50% markup, even on my farm products, we've got to get that cash from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so the farm stays low overhead and, you know, yes, an initial investment, but an initial investment that when you go and sell your property someday, it's going to come right back at you.
Exactly. Okay. So let's talk about the legality of that. Did you get any permits or anything with the county? You're flying under the radar. How does that work?
I mean, I'm a big fan of flying under the radar.
So am I.
And I mean, we're in like a Super Bowl area. We have like a porta potty out here that I get cleaned every week. So, you know, there's not really like a sewage, there's no sewage drainage. There's no, you know, nobody's saying, oh, you can't have these RVs come and park. And cause they're not parked to anything other than electric.
Yeah.
But as far as like insurance goes, like we have an agritourism policy. And then like people, when they're booking, you know, I ask about their liability insurance, and they have to like agree on, you know, the like a waiver about their like the land, and that they understand it's a working farm, and there is, you know, there's hazards, like there's electric fencing, there's uneven ground. But I don't think when people roll up here and they see that we live in an RV, it's not like a mansion, you know, I think people kind of respect like what we're doing, and we rarely have anybody that has anything like slightly negative to say.
Gotcha. So it's gone relatively streamlined. And yeah, because I remember back in New York, we had a friend that tried to do the same thing. And again, I think he tried to put in a lot larger scale. I think he had like 13 or 15 sites, and they pretty much shut him down. But I think, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how he tried to position it. And I don't think he was trying to work especially well with the city or the county on that. But I, what you're doing there, I think that's fabulous. And if we could on our property, unfortunately, where we are in the municipality. So yeah. Literally everything we do is incredibly scrutinized. Like and we can't
there's even, good things yeah. and bad things about that. You know, you're probably right there where there's a lot of potential customers.
Oh, 12,000 cars drive by our farm a day.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, once we get our farm store up and running, which hopefully is next spring, yeah, we won't need that kind of income because we'll be able to turn over so much product to the store. But I just love that aspect because one of the things my wife and I are incredibly passionate about is the education side. And, you know, even the sunflowers, like we'll probably end up breaking even on it. And we've grown our email list, I think, to 400 people with just people coming out when they book a ticket. Cool. But the aspect of just getting people to the farm, getting people to walk through the field and just see, oh, this is how a sunflower plant grows. And this is, you know, this is what a honeybee looks like. That aspect is so foreign to people. Yeah. It just blows my mind.
And it's so important, you know, that education is so important. And so I have like this employee now, right? And she's got her set days, whereas before she was kind of floating when would plan out each week and say, because she's a student. And so now she's in her school started back. And, you know, so she has class on certain days and times. And I said, well, you know, Katie, what do you think about if we had open hours from the days that you're here? So at least if I know that you're on the farm and people come up to purchase, they can see you. But something that I'm going to have to contend with are people just coming to look around, right? Uh-huh. And so it's one of those things where we want to educate people. And, you know, even if people come up and they don't buy anything, eventually, like it will just grow us more. And so that's something that, you know, just like breaking even with the sunflowers and growing your email list, it is just advertisement for your farm for when the right customer comes by and hears about you.
Yeah. And the other thing too, is it was also to make sure that the city was on board because everything runs through the city council. So there's 5 city council members and we know that we have to obviously have 3 of them like what we're doing in order for stuff for our variances to get passed through. Cause we're going to be going after a significant amount of variances because we're not allowed technically allowed to have like many animals and we want to have a little tiny petting zoo with a couple pigs. Okay. So yeah, so that's the kind of stuff too, that we're trying to do. And several of city council members have already come out, visited the field. So that was another aspect is just making sure that, you know, the city realizes, hey, we're here. We want to be part of the community. We really want to contribute.
Yeah. And I think that might, and I don't know if it's too, you know, too soon to talk in on that, but about the pay what you can produce stand.
Talk to us about that.
So, you know, part of like, all right, I'm from New Jersey originally, and my husband, he's from South Georgia. I am a transplant down here, and we are in like an area of South Carolina where everybody is originally from here pretty much. Mm. And so, you know, coming in, starting a business, being a Yankee is, you know, that's kind of a big deal. People, when I first moved to the area 5 years ago and you talk to people, you just say like, hey, how are you? And the first thing they might say is, you're not from around here, are you? And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, because of my accent or whatever. And so I really wanted the community to realize like, we're here for you. Yes, I wanted to buy land here because the land is more inexpensive. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, that is part of it. But also because I think the area is beautiful because I think there's a lot that needs to be done. I think there's a lot of education that's missing. And so part of what we decided to do when we started raising vegetables was to put up a pay what you can produce stand. And so that produce stand started at our old farm. And we have a lease on a hoop house that is about 30 minutes from our farm now where we mostly plant tomatoes, but the lease is a free lease. Okay. And it's this guy who, you know, this guy's got a lot of money. This is one of his hunting properties that he probably gets some sort of tax credit for having it be like used for agriculture. And he wanted a local farmer to use the hoop or to use the area for gardening and a hoop house and profit. And so he doesn't want my money. He doesn't want my vegetables. And I tried to think like, okay, well, this is a perfect opportunity where I can pay it forward because mm-hmm. I can pay it forward to the local community. So where we are, not only is it people that have been born and raised here for generations, but it's also incredibly poor. Our county is, as of, I don't know, as of last year, I think it was the poorest county in South Carolina, if it's wow. not still. And so you have people that have no cars, they have no transportation, they have houses that have tarps over the roofs because of leaks that they can't fix. But also at the same time, just their neighbor could be fairly wealthy and have a giant house. And so it's a really interesting area when you drive through, because you see a lot of poverty, but you also see money. And so we wanted to make the community feel like we were here for everyone. So if you can't afford to buy eggs from me, if you can't afford to buy my meat products, I still have a place for you on our farm. And that's where the Pay What You Can produce stand came in. So we crowdfunded for the materials to build the stand, which was $1,500. We, you know, it's like a small open shed. If you go on our website, you'll find it, pictures of it. It's really cute. And we basically put our produce that we grow, it's all organically grown, and we stock it seasonally. So when I had tomatoes coming in this year and I was picking 200-300 pounds of tomatoes a week, I was putting them, like leaving them out on the stand until I would go to market. Whatever wasn't selling on the stand, I took to market and sold at, you know, a mm-hmm. profit price. And otherwise people come and they put their money in the box. They can come 24/7, 365, as long as there's something on the stand, and they get what they need and they pay what they can. And, that was, you know, that's part of showing people in the community, just like you, that we're here to contribute. We're not just here to profit off of a you know, our low tax rate or whatever. Like we really want to give back. We really want to educate. If that means that a kid that has never had, you know, what do people eat when they're poor? They get food stamps and they buy food that is processed, right? They
need it horrible for them.
Shelf stable. So if that meant that a kid came up to the stand with their mom and they said like, oh, what's this? And, you know, they got to try a green bean or a tomato or a cucumber or a beet or something, see something that they've never seen before, and then think and be told by their parent or their guardian, whoever they're with, that came from that farm right there. And if that inspires them to drive up here and look at the animals and the kids see something that they've never seen before, then that's great. And we've done part of our job right there. We've provided an interest, we've piqued interest in a child that never sees those things. And so that's, you know, that's part of it. And it's been a really amazing part of what we do. We grew sunflowers here. I did them in pretty like heavy clusters all along our highway frontage. Mm-hmm. And when the sunflowers were in full bloom, it was like crazy hot. We were getting no water. I had no irrigation. We had no rain. And so I just started cutting sunflowers and then taking bundles to like local businesses, you know, as just a little thing to brighten up their, you know, their day. Mm-hmm. Just trying to do things so that people realize like we're here to give back to the community. And so I think that's such an important part, is that we don't just run our business and we drive over to these more wealthy areas with our products, and that's where we focus on selling our products. Because yeah, that's at the end of the day, I can never afford to have a farm where all of my customers live. But even if my local community isn't my customer base, I still want to have something here for them.
Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you will find that the local people, if they can get behind your farm, you can, and I don't want to say this in the wrong way, but when you build community, there's always, everyone is better for it. Like last night, the other night, we were talking to my neighbor and his dad was over, and he was like, oh my gosh, I wish I had talked to you a couple of weeks ago. He said, we literally tore out 3 walk-in coolers at our demo he was doing. And I was like, gosh, you know, is there something about that? It's like, you know, thinking about how can I embed myself in my community, because that's kind of the opportunities that they probably, we're in a very blue collar community, which is, you know, probably the average home price in this town, gosh, I would say maybe 150. There's a lot of 100,000. There's a lot of, you know, there's some 200s and then some new neighborhoods. But yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing where there's a lot that, you know, if you support them, they can support you. And it's not just that, but it's just that matter of community building. They can feel excited about helping you move forward. And you can know that you're feeding them amazing food, because you and I both know that the food that so many of our people in our US eat is just so bad for them.
Right.
And you know, when I grew up, when I was really young, we ate pretty well, but kind of like when we started our farm, we weren't in it just for the food. We were in it because, oh, people like organic vegetables. That's great. And, you know, we still drank a little bit of soda here and now, but as I've gotten older, every single, you know, my wife and I now, we have Saturday or Friday, I think it's Friday night's our cheat night. So we're gluten-free, no sugar throughout the week. Friday night hits. And then we can feel bad on Sunday and Monday or Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. But it's one of those things, like I never really thought about that until I got a little bit older and I went to a nutritionist and we started looking at some of the challenges I've been having with my diet and just my health. And so now it's like ingrained in me. And I look at these people that are coming to the city council meeting with a Coke. And then while they're sitting there, they're talking about how great it is that the Dairy Queen, literally a 300 yards from our farm, has a line 20 cars deep
right.
every single night. And yeah. that's my goal, is to change that, because yeah. we know that that is not helping our community thrive. It's unbelievable the amount of cancer fundraisers in this little 5,000 town person oh, wow. town. Right. I mean, like right now, people say, oh yeah, there's three people in town that literally just got found out they have cancer. They're starting chemo and they want to come out to your farm and take pictures before they go through all that. Wow. And I'm just heartbroken.
Yeah.
I'm just like, this can change and we can change that. And so again, anyway, that self-serve idea is getting that those people from the community that can't afford the prices you need to charge to make your farm work. Yeah. But it just allows them to be able to partake into that.
And don't get me wrong. Like there is a selfish idea behind it, because we get Facebook shares and we get things of people recognize, oh, the pay what you can farm stand. So we do get things out of it, but you hope that your hope would be that you give more than you get out of it. So if for someone that's thinking about starting a stand like that, you know, at the end of the day, you will get something out of it. The first thing people always ask me is, well, do people actually pay? Guess what? The people that can pay extra. Like people come and they might just throw a donation in there and take nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
the people that care about what you do, I have people that come and stay right in these RVs and they stop. And, you know, I had somebody just hand me a 50 the other day, just as a thank you. They'd already paid for their space. They already bought meat. And then they said, we just love what you're doing. Here's some extra money, you know? And so it will come back around to people. And I never worry about how much money is in the box. I have barely checked the box, but it does help. And it's a great way to get your name out there in your local community. And you know, and to do something that gives back.
Absolutely. So what would you say, now that you've been farming for a couple of years, what would you say the biggest mistakes beginning farmers make are?
I mean, you know, I think for anybody, it's too much too soon. I always tell people, like when we're doing our consulting and they tell me about what they want to do and how fast they want to move and their goals, right? And they are just like, you hear about people getting like, well, we got chickens. Then a month later we got cows and a month later we got, and these are people that never had animals before ever. And it's like for anybody that wants to start with animals, I always say like figure one species out and then move to the next, like keep that species alive and thriving for a season at least, and then move on to the next thing. You know, for us, that's what we did. I always had horses when I was, you know, I had show horses growing up. So I got horses was the first thing that we got when we had our 2 acres of land, because that was a dream of mine to have horses again. And so I got a horse. And then after I had the horse and I kept her alive for a few months, we, you know, and I remembered how to take care of a horse because I hadn't had him in a while and everything was fine. I got some chickens. You know, and after my chickens started laying eggs and everything was fine and we had some fencing up and I didn't feel overwhelmed, I got a few pigs and we raised some pigs for ourselves. And then once we butchered those first pigs and I felt like I had that under control, we started with rabbits. And, you know, it was kind of like if we started with all of these things and, you know, something happens, some chickens get sick or a disease comes through or, you know, something gets out and you've got all of these other variables that, you know, no doubt you're going to have many problems. Like the goats are my newest species that we have. And I started with them in March of 2019, I guess. And the goats give me a run for my money, like trying to holistically manage them without wormer all the time and not overfeeding them and trying to figure out, well, how much forage will they actually eat? Am I feeding them too much that they're not foraging enough? Am I not feeding them enough even though they're foraging, and are they skinny? Like that the goats have been really difficult for me in trying to find that balance. Whereas I'm at this point in our career, I can look out at the pigs and I can say, oh, okay, that pig looks like it, you know, it's probably needs to be wormed, or, you know, oh, that pig is a month pregnant. You know, like I can look at these animals now and tell what they need. I still can't do that with the goats. And so until I can do that with the goats, I'm not getting any other species. You know, I would love to have a cow. I would love to have milk for myself. I would love to raise a cow just for beef for us. Yeah. But until I can look at those goats and I can say, you need X, Y, and Z, I'm not doing it, because it's not fair to the animals that I already have. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that people, you know, too much too soon, and then they get overwhelmed and burn out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of goats do you have? What breed?
I've got dairy goats. So I've got Nubians, Saanens. I've got, Nubians and Saanens. I had an Alpine. She got her head stuck in a fence and died.
Ooh.
You know, so there's a, like, you know, these things happen, right? So you live and you learn with fencing choices and,
yeah,
you know, so, and so
you're raising the goats for the milk then?
Yeah, we don't sell any goat dairy products. I drink the milk, we use the milk, and then we use them for clearing. You know, they're great. Gotcha. For helping us as in our like initial clearing of spaces where it's completely overgrown. It's a lot easier to stick a goat in there than stick a herd of pigs. You know, I can call if the goats get out or whatever, if the fence is, you know, hits a tree or something and is like the electric, you know, shorts out, I can easily wrangle goats back up. But the pigs, that's a, you know, it's a whole nother story. So the goats really help in the initial clear out.
What is your favorite farm tool?
My favorite farm tool? It's a good question.
You can say the excavator.
Yeah. I mean, you know, really, like, I have this little truck that we paid $200 for, and it's like, I think it's like an, I don't know, 1980 something, crappy, old, nasty looking truck. But I can use that thing for everything. Putting feed on the back of when I collect the chickens for butchering, and I put their cages on the back of it. It's small. It's like an old, you know, whatever, like a Mitsubishi or a Zuzu or something. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's small, right? So you can get into small places. I hit things all the time with it, and it's not a big deal. Like my husband, he has this truck that, you know, he's got a really nice Dodge that I drive to the markets. And when I go pick up like big loads, and I'm not the best with it. And it's got a lot of dents on it by little accidents I've had around the farm. And it's just better if I don't drive it, on the farm. but that little truck, if I hit a tree, like, it's no big deal.
Yes.
You know, that's probably my favorite tool. You know, I can do a lot in it. I can throw stuff up on the back of it. I don't have to worry about it. I mean, it barely has a front seat. So if I spill my coffee, it's not even on the front seat, because I don't really even have one. Like, it's fine. Everything is good.
It reminds me of a little Nissan we used to have. And I was actually gone, when I say interned at Polyface in 2012, and I was gone, and my brother calls me up and he's like, yeah, we need a new truck. I was like, oh, what happened? He's like, well, we had to take it in to get this done. And when they got it up in the lift, it literally pretty much cracked in half.
Oh,
and
so
I was like, okay, go find another truck to buy.
Yeah.
But I know the type you're talking about.
Yeah. We're always like, you know, the jumper cables are, or not the jumper cables, but the battery thing looks corroded and that's not working, or this isn't working. Or, you know, I'll tell like the volunteers or like my worker, I'll be like, if it doesn't start, kick it in neutral. Like, it's like, you know, it's got like its little quirks. And but that's probably the best $200 that I've ever spent.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're fabulous. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
So you can find us on Facebook. I know our farm is like, I know it's a complicated name. So it's Whippoorwill Farms SC. So you can find us on Facebook and on Instagram. And I thought when I named the farm, I thought it would be great, right? Because we had this really unique name, but it's very hard to spell. So it's Whippoorwill Farms with an S and then SC. And that's also at .com if you want to look at our website. And but a whippoorwill is a bird that we have down here. Mm-hmm. And they come every spring and fall. So we hear them on our farm. And my husband and I met, we were living on Whippoorwill Way. So, you know, I thought it was like so cute to name the farm that, but ever since it's been fun trying to tell people what our website is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Coming full circle for you. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a fascinating conversation, one I've highly enjoyed. It's just so, I enjoy having some, obviously I enjoy all the guests we have because there's so many different stories, but I enjoyed the new farmers because they have a lot of energy and I feel like they have so much to contribute to this industry as we continue to move it forward. So thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was really awesome.
Looking to start or grow your farm business? You need a compelling farm plan that you can share with investors, convince your significant other with, or just to give yourself peace of mind. We have created a new program called the Start Your Farm Intensive. In it, you'll learn how to develop your farm idea to make sure you take all the factors into consideration for your context and your climate. You'll learn how to craft a one-page business plan that helps clearly define your target customer and lay out the necessary characteristics of your business. You will understand the three financial documents that every farm needs to fill out to make sure you are making money. And we'll give you all that as templates too, so you have the templates to fill out for your farm business. We'll also go through funding, so where to go for funding for the various stages and parts of your business. Starting a farm is hard. Starting a farm without a proven plan is almost impossible. Join us today. Go to growingfarmers.com/start for more information. Now, what did past students have to say? Corey says, the exercises and spreadsheets helped me make the learning process easier and more real. Jenna says, I gained the support system and resources I needed for when I'm ready for the next step. And finally, the worksheets make you think out every aspect of the business step by step. Go ahead, join us today, growingfarmers.com/start.
Hey, thriving farmers. Next week on the podcast, I've got Casey Orst-Winch, who is from Honey Tree Farm. Now, Casey and his wife, Tori, are second year farmers. They've been doing a fabulous job down the Charlotte, North Carolina area. And he shares about getting started. He talks about the challenges with building infrastructure. He shares a weekly video on their YouTube channel, which is for their customers as well as other farmers. He talks about how that benefits them and helps that drive sales. And we just talked about their transitioning in a pandemic year to change up their marketing and bring Tori on the farm full time. So very cool interview. Really appreciate him coming on and just sharing from the heart exactly how it's going on their farm. And I know you're going to enjoy it. So join me next week. And we talk to Casey.
So there you have it. Another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.